Hello, I'm Michael Serapio, and this is the Primetime Politics Podcast. Tonight on Primetime Politics, ejected from the House.
Wacko policy by this wacko prime minister.
Pierre Poilievre is thrown out for using unparliamentary language, ejected after a heated exchange with the prime minister as each described the other of being extremists. We'll share that exchange with you and examine why things are getting so testy in the House. And we'll speak with Canada's parliamentary budget officer. We'll get Yves Giroux's assessment on the latest Liberal budget and also explore whether the government is being transparent enough with Canadians about the financial challenges ahead. This is Primetime Politics. Hello, everyone. I'm Michael Serapio. Question period was more heated than usual today. The Conservative leader and the Prime Minister engaging in a testy exchange, one that ended with the ejection of Pierre Poilievre for using unparliamentary language and refusing to withdraw his comments, calling the Prime Minister wacko. Take a look at what happened.
When will we put an end to this wacko policy by this wacko Prime Minister?
No. I'm going to ask the Honourable Leader of the Opposition to withdraw that term, which is not considered parliamentary.
Mr. Speaker, I replace wacko with extremist. He is an extremist.
The Honourable Member to please. I'm going to ask the Leader of the Opposition once again to just withdraw that comment, please. And I'll invite the Honourable Member. I'm going to ask the Honourable Leader of the Opposition to please withdraw that comment and simply withdraw that comment.
I'll replace it with radical Baptist policy.
I am not asking to replace. I'm asking the Honourable Member to just simply withdraw.
Mr. Speaker, I replace the word wacko with extremist.
I'm going to ask the Honourable Leader of the Opposition one last time to please withdraw that comment and simply withdraw that comment.
I simply withdraw and replace with the aforementioned adjective.
Mr. Poilievre, I have to name you for disregarding the authority of the chair. Pursuant to the authority granted to me by Standing Order 11, I order you to withdraw from the House and from any participation by video conference for the remainder of this day's sitting.
And with that, Pierre Poilievre did leave the House, as did his caucus. And to talk about this, we're now joined by Muhammad Ali, a Liberal strategist and vice president at Crestview Strategy, Sean Murphy, a former chief of staff to several former Conservative whips, and Melanie Richet, a former director of communications for NDP leader Jagmeet Singh, both of whom are now principals with Ernst Cliff Strategies. Hello to all three of you.
Hello.
Hey. So here we have the Conservative leader. He was trying to make a point about the pilot project in British Columbia to decriminalize drugs, but he not only used unparliamentary language, he seemed to be goading the speaker by not backing down on the word a wacko, replacing it with radical and extremist. You know, we're going to talk about the speaker in a moment, but I'll begin with you, Sean. Does Pierre Poilievre help or hinder his cause when this type of episode unfolds in the Commons?
Well, first, Michael, I went and looked through Beauchesne's rules and parliamentary rules and order, and wacko was not listed as one of the unparliamentary terms, but that list has grown over time. But like you mentioned, Poilievre did try to correct the record three times, where he said that he would replace the word with extremist or replace the word with radical, and even said he would withdraw. So I think the speaker should have just taken yes for an answer instead of inserting himself into the story here. So the situation is that the government has been facing really tough questions from Polyev for over a year, but certainly going back to Friday on this when Premier Eby asked that the government reverse this policy. And unfortunately today the speaker inserted himself into that story.
Yeah, Mohammed, what do you say to that?
Look, I mean, Pierre Poilievre loves to play this sort of like name calling. That's been his style since he's been an MP. So I'm not surprised that he went that far to go and call WACO. I mean, like, let's be grown-ups here. I mean, question period has kind of denigrated into a pretty toxic, unbearable watch. Like, I mean, Canadians are watching this, and this is what they're seeing, that the, you know, someone who wants to be prime minister one day can't seem to muster, like, you know, it's fair to criticize the, you know, government, but like, come on, let's act like adults and use adult language. So I think it's fair for the speaker to push back and ask him to change it. He asked him four times, and Pierre was trying to go to him. So, and the speaker was not having it. So I think the speaker did what was in within his powers and told him, say, take a hike.
Okay, Melanie.
Yeah, I think I don't think that Mr. Poilievre helped himself the way that he behaved today. And the reason that I don't think so is this is such a sensitive and important topic that needs to be handled with really measured. It needs to be measured the way that you discuss, you know, the toxic drug crisis in BC. And the fact that this kind of devolved into that, I don't think tells people watching at home that this is somebody who is handling such an important and devastating crisis with the care that it requires. So I think that he did not help himself as it relates to this issue, showing people at home who are expecting him to be statesmanlike to handle this issue with the care that it needs. As it relates to you know, the name calling and whatnot, I think it's what people have come to expect from Pierre Poilievre, but I think that that fact that it's what people have come to expect from Pierre Poilievre is something that's going to hurt him and then lead up to the next election. So the more we see this kind of play out, whether or not the House is, you know, toxic, the fact that he continues to show this side of himself, I don't think tells people at home who are looking for him to be, you know, the grown-up in the room or a little bit more reasonable, that he can be that person. So I don't think, you know, partisan hat aside, if I was watching this at home today, I'd be pleased or impressed by the person who's running to be the next prime minister of this country.
Yeah, well, Sean, isn't that what Liberals have been banking on when it comes to Pierre Poilievre, that when push comes to shove, they make the argument that people are not going to be happy with the I guess the diplomatic way of putting it, is a lack of statesmanship?
You know what, I'm not terribly surprised that that the government, the Liberals and the NDP, will want to focus more on his choice of words here than on the issue itself, right? He and his caucus have been talking about this for months, and increasingly so ever since Friday when the premier asked to reverse this policy. Yesterday, Poilievre presented or made a request for an emergency debate in the House, which would have taken place after hours, which only the Speaker can grant, and the Speaker refused it. So this didn't start today. They've been trying to get this issue on the floor of the Commons for months now, but certainly yesterday and today. And you can see that the frustration at the refusal by the government and the Speaker to have that debate in the House is boiling over.
Okay, that leads me to think about the Speaker, which I'll get to in a second. But Mohammed, very quickly, your thoughts on this, because when it comes to Liberal strategy, and you who better than you at the panel talk about this, you oftentimes Liberals point to Pierre Poilievre's almost Shakespearean flaw as this, you know, combative pettiness at times.
Yeah, look, if he's playing into it. If Conservatives want to change his image, change how he appeals to Canadians, like, he needs to do better. Like, I think ultimately at the end of the day, there was a way to hold the government account. There's a way to ask tough questions. Like, if your only ability to ask for a tough question is to get into childish name calling, then you probably aren't very fit for the job of being a prime minister one day if that's what you want. You need to kind of act like the adult in the room. And I agree with Melanie, like, if you want to act like it, like, you have to act like what you want for the job. And, you know, if they're going to choose this path instead of taking the opportunity, to Sean's point, it's an important issue. Grill the government. You have a huge dictionary that you can use different words to grill the government, and he chose to go down a childish path. So it really isn't helping him. I think if he wants to shed that image, he needs to choose a better approach.
Okay. Now, we've mentioned the speaker more than once, and I do want to talk about that, Melanie, because, you know, before Pierre Poilievre was ejected from the House, we also saw Conservative MP Rachel Thomas ejected from the House, and that was after she basically called the speaker disgraceful, or his actions being disgraceful. In fact, Conservatives are now calling Greg Fergus the Liberal Speaker of the House. What does that say about the kind of respect that Greg Fergus can or cannot have in the House, and whether or not he can control members of the Commons?
Right. You know, to be fair to Greg Fergus, I think the temperature in the House of Commons was pretty elevated by the time that he took over as the role of Speaker. I think from the get-go, folks thought that he was maybe a little bit more biased than what the position of Speaker usually requires. And I think coming into, you know, a House that's already pretty heated, and the fact that folks thought he was maybe too close to the Prime Minister than previous Speakers probably didn't help. And I think we've seen a bit of a, not an erosion, but it just continues to get worse. And you know, unfortunately, the Speaker has made a few false moves when we saw the, you know, him giving a speech to the Ontario Liberals. So that every little incident, I think, makes it worse. I don't know that I would have maybe acted differently than the Speaker today as it relates to, you know, the name-calling, or you called the Prime Minister wacko. You know, it's different when you call a policy that, but you called him that directly. So I think, I don't know that I would have acted differently as Greg Fergus, but the context definitely doesn't help, and I think that's what we're kind of seeing, the heat and the elevated temperature in the room. I don't know that it would be better if it was a different speaker. Unfortunately, I think that's kind of the moment that we're at. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it seems like it's a battle that unfortunately Speaker Fergus can't win right now.
Yeah, Mohammed, what do you say about Greg Fergus's position right now?
Look, it's a tough position. I agree with Melanie. Like, the House has become quite toxic. It's quite, you know, challenging to the best of time. But like at this point where there's a caucus that has happily gone into making it as unbearable as possible, has used it for all the wrong reasons of what questionnaires should be about. Like, Canadians watch that to see, hey, is the opposition holding the government account? Are they getting the answers they need? And if you're not getting the answers you need, feel free to keep pressing the government. That is the whole point of question period. But the speaker, and I agree with Melanie, that there is a bit more context of, you know, the previous speaker had their controversy. And so Greg Fergus is really trying to bring some civility. Like, he is a pretty honorable man. So he is trying to bring that civility back to the House at a time where it just keeps denigrating. So, you know, it's a tough job. It's a job that's an honorable job, an important job as speaker, and should be respected as such. And it wasn't a thing appropriate for Rachel Thomas to kind of go at the speaker in that way.
Mm-hmm. Sean?
Yeah, so you mentioned the dynamics and the toxicity in the House, and I obviously those dynamics have existed long before today. You know, taking some of the players from today, going in the Wayback Machine, at one point the Prime Minister stormed across the House, grabbed the Chief Opposition Whip by the elbow, and elbowed an NDP member in the chest at the same time. And Greg Fergus was the first on his feet to call her, to compare her to a soccer player who was diving in the World Cup. But you don't have to go back that far, right? The dynamics from today are very much a result of the Speaker refusing that debate yesterday on this very important issue, and him refusing, inserting himself into the issue today when he didn't take the withdrawal that Poilievre offered, flawed as it might have been in his view.
Mm-hmm. Okay, you know, we're quickly running out of time, but I have to ask, because we only have 7 sitting weeks left before the summer break, and I'm wondering if this is what we can expect now. You know, you're a radical. No, you're a radical. You're an extremist. No, you're an extremist. Is this the level of the debate that we're going to see in these closing weeks, Sean?
Well, I lived through many silly seasons, and it seems that they're getting earlier and earlier every year. But that's how things go when you're 9 years into a government, and the tension is as high as it is, and particularly with an issue like this, we're talking life and death. People are very passionate about this one, and I think as long as you're seeing, 6 people a day on average dying in British Columbia, those BC MPs are going to be coming out and they're going to be loud about it. And if they're seeing that the government's not acting, and the government's not responding to the calls from British Columbia to reverse the policy, I think that the tensions will remain high.
Melanie?
Yeah, I think this is something that we've seen maybe for a few years now. I, you know, on the Hill was last on the Hill in 2022, and I at the end of it was no longer going to the lobby because I was just like, that was not the way that I wanted to start or end my day. So credit to Sean for lasting in the lobby for so long. But it does, I think, get progressively worse as we're getting closer to the election. And to your point of silly season, like, I think people are stressed. They need to be back in the riding to the folks that are connecting them to the local issues instead of being, you know, in this echo chamber of hearing themselves and hearing their fake anger sometimes, I guess. Not that it's fake. These issues are super important and they deserve all the care. But I think they probably need to go home and they probably need to go hear from folks on the doorstep about what matters to them and what they want them in Ottawa fighting for. The closer we get to that date happening, I think the worse it's going to get in the House, unfortunately.
Yeah. And as I said, 7 weeks. Mohammed, what do you say to that?
I agree that it's just going to get worse. I think we're our silly season. You know, it's consecutive weeks. Some of these MPs don't get to see their families regularly. The issues become thornier and government is trying to pass legislation very quickly. And so all those emotions boil over into question period. And unfortunately, I expect it to not get better. And in fact, maybe get even nastier as the choice of politics has sort of just gone that direction, and question period often is a reflection of that. So I expect that right up to the end, when the House rises, that we'll see sort of this hot, contested sort of rhetoric kind of taking place.
Okay. Well, which means, of course, we'll convene again in the future. But for now, Mohammed, Sean, and Melanie, thank you for today. Well, time now for a look at what happened in politics today.
Generation Afro-Canadian. I only need to go back one generation to find a time when people that looked like us were barred from certain educational professions and educational professions and pursuits simply because of what we look like. As Canadians, we thought that those days of blatant discrimination were behind us. But I'm sad to say that because of Bill 21, we are right back to those dark days.
The National Council of Canadian Muslims spoke in front of the Supreme Court this morning after filing a motion to appeal Quebec's Bill 21. The group is calling on the Supreme Court to overturn a lower court decision that upheld the law and the Quebec government's preemptive use of the notwithstanding clause. The law prevents public servants in positions of authority in Quebec from wearing religious symbols, including hijabs, crucifixes, and yarmulkes. The Canadian government has said it would argue against the law when it came to the Supreme Court.
Nuclear is not green. And the risk of the contamination when you mine uranium, and all you have to do is go ask our sisters and brothers of the Navajo Nation, and the continued despair that they have to live.
Indigenous leaders joined by Green leader Elizabeth May spoke on the Hill today, voicing their concerns over the government's plan to expand Canada's nuclear energy footprint. They say the government has not properly consulted Indigenous communities on plans to build modular reactors, nor on plans to transport, store, and dispose of nuclear waste on Indigenous territory. It's a move that the leaders argue violates their rights under the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. And former Conservative MP Kenny Chu appeared at the House Ethics Committee this morning, testifying on his experiences with misinformation and disinformation. Chu alleges that he and the Conservative Party, as well as Chinese Canadians, were targeted by a campaign from the People's Republic of China. Chu says it happened in the 2021 campaign, which he lost to his Liberal opponent.
It seeks to sow discord, erode trust, and undermine the foundations of truth. In the crucible of Canada's electoral process, truth and deceptions collided, leaving lasting scars on our democracy.
Chu previously testified on the alleged disinformation campaign at the public inquiry into foreign interference earlier this year. An interim report from that commission is expected later this week. Well, legislation to expand the capital gains tax will be separate from the government's main budget motion, despite the fact it is a major plank of the Liberals' fiscal plan. This prompted journalists to ask why. The Deputy Prime Minister, Chrystia Freeland, denied it was about wedging the Conservatives, but also did not explain the reason behind the move.
The purpose of our budget, the central goal of our budget, is fairness for every generation. It is recognizing that we need to unlock the promise of Canada for millennials and Gen Z, and it's recognizing we need to make significant investments to do that.
Meanwhile, the Parliamentary Budget Officer has taken a look at the numbers in the plan, and joining us right now is the PBO, Yves Giroux. Mr. Giroux, thank you for joining us.
Always a pleasure.
Listen, I know the government plan to deal with the capital gains adjustments separately is not necessarily in your report, but I do want to begin there because given the fact that it will be considered separately, not in the budget bill, does that in any way worry you about the kind of assessment you can give to the government economic plan?
Regardless of whether something is included in one Budget Implementation Act or another, it does not prevent us from looking at a specific issue. In that case, the capital gains inclusion rate, we were planning on taking a deeper look at that anyways. So whether it's in BIA 1, BIA 2, or as a standalone instrument, legislative instrument, we'll have a look at that no matter what. The moment it's mentioned in a budget and it is a government policy, and also considering the level of interest that there is for this topic, it's something we will be looking into no matter where it is implemented, whether it be a Budget Implementation Act or another vehicle.
Okay, so keeping an eye for that. You know, let's talk about what is in your report. And funnily enough, I actually want to begin with fiscal 23-24 because there was a $1.8 billion set aside for new measures. Those measures, though, as you noted, were never announced. How problematic is that?
Well, it's a bit problematic for very good reasons. It does not allow parliamentarians to do their work of scrutinizing public spending and challenging the government on its spending plans. If they don't know what these amounts are for, there's very little way or no way for them to know whether it's a legitimate expenditure or set aside and what it's being spent on or what it will be spent on. It's most likely for legal liabilities, given that it was for last fiscal year, but there's no certain way of knowing that, especially for parliamentarians. So in that sense, it's worrisome from an accountability and transparency perspective.
Mm-hmm. So at that point then, are you calling on the government to detail what exactly that money is being used for?
It would be a good idea for the government to at least tell us categories of expenditures that are included in that. Everybody understands that you don't want the government to itemize its estimated legal liabilities when it's being sued by fear of revealing its hand, and then whatever amount it has set aside to become the ceiling for a settlement. But in aggregate, the government could tell us that so much is for the anticipated settlement of legal liabilities. That amount is for benefits, and the cost of future benefits that has to be booked in a given year. So we can have a better idea as to the purpose of these amounts, much more granular and refined than just a provision.
Mm-hmm. Now, in terms of numbers, you also write the fact that your office, the projected budgetary deficits from PBO are $5.3 billion higher annually on average over 23-24 all the way up to 28-29. So higher than what the finance minister laid out in 2024 budget. Why the discrepancy here?
It's mostly related to a different perspective on the level of nominal GDP going forward. So we anticipate that the economic growth will be roughly in the ballpark of what the Minister of Finance has indicated, but the minister has tabled or is tabling on or counting on slightly higher GDP inflation than what we are estimating. And GDP inflation means that nominal GDP is slightly higher in the Minister of Finance's budget than in our own economic and fiscal outlook. And because the nominal GDP is the broadest definition of the tax base, then there's a small difference between our numbers and the government's numbers related to the government revenues, mostly on the personal income tax side.
Okay, so that's the work behind the conclusion. But what will that actually do to the fiscal anchor that this government, you know, really does continue to use as its measure? Will they actually get to the debt to GDP ratio below 1% by 26, 27, as they predict, if their numbers are slightly off than what you're looking at?
Well, their fiscal anchor is twofold. One, a declining debt to GDP ratio in the medium term, which will be difficult to do, but they're playing on words to ensure that they are indeed meeting that that fiscal anchor. And the second anchor, which you alluded to, is a deficit of 1% of GDP or lower in 2026-27 and ongoing. And on that front, it will be much more difficult to attain without increasing taxes or reducing expenditures in many areas, because based on the budget, the deficit is expected to be 0.9% of GDP in 26-27, and there's two budgets still to go between now and that fiscal year. We've seen what the government is keen on doing. It has a propensity to introduce new measures and introduce new spending measures, so that doesn't leave them much room for maneuver in 26-27 if they want to meet that 1% target, the deficit relative to the GDP, without increasing taxes.
Okay, and yes, deficit to GDP, because I tripped on that, so thank you for the clarity. But you know, before you go, because we're quickly running out of time though, on the matter of savings, the government is looking to reduce the size of the public service. They're going to do this through attrition. But there's also this number of new social programs that also need to be run. Will the government have to make cuts to the public service to meet the 5,000 reduction goal?
Well, if on a net basis they really mean cutting 5,000 employees from the current levels, and they also deliver on all these programs and initiatives and spending items in the budget, many of which will require a substantial number of public servants. So if they want to deliver on all these, for example, CRA call centers improving their performance, and that's just one example. So if they deliver on all these budget measures and they also reduce the overall number of public servants by 5,000 over 4 years, they will have to cut in other sectors of government. Otherwise, there is no way they can reduce 5,000 employees, deliver on budget measures, and not cut anywhere. That's just not working.
Yves Giroux, I wish we had more time, but I always appreciate the clarity on things. Thank you for the time tonight.
Always a pleasure.
And that is our program for this Tuesday. I'm Michael Serapio. For everyone here at CPAC, thank you for watching Primetime Politics. We'll be back tomorrow night. We'll see you then.